their counterparts on the ground. We have relayed in no uncertain terms that what we need to see in order for this diplomacy to be effective is de-escalation. The Russians have heard that from the very start of this process. And if I recall, even at the outset of the first meeting of the Strategic Stability Dialogue, the dialogue that Deputy Secretary Sherman attended with Foreign Minister Ryabkov in Geneva in January, that was a key message that we imparted publicly, but also privately, that in order for this process to work, we need to see de-escalation. Until now, that is a message that the Russians have not heeded.
Okay, just two more questions. And, you know, they're saying we're moving back forces. You're saying, you know, they're not moving any meaningful amount of forces, and in fact, they're doing the opposite. Why do you think they are making these claims when not only is there, you know, what the intelligence that you guys are observing and then talking about publicly, but there's commercial satellite imagery, there's people who are posting stuff on TikTok. You know, why? I'm just curious about what you think their thinking is there, given the fact that it's something that, you know, in this day and age with the access to imagery out there in the public, that they think that they could sort of get away with if that's what you guys are saying.
Well, you're right that there are Russian words and then there are Russian actions. And it should be clear to everyone, it is clear to everyone, takes the time to investigate, that their words do not match their actions, and in fact, their words stand in stark contrast to their actions. And you can see that on social media, you can see that on publicly available satellite imagery, you can see that through any number of means. That's a question for the Russian Federation. What I will say, and this is as much from an historical perspective as it is from what we're seeing now, this is the Russian playbook. This is the playbook the Russians have used in the past, including in 2014, to paint a picture, or at least to attempt to paint a picture publicly, while they do the opposite in a way that they seek to obfuscate, in a way that they seek to obscure and to hide. This is not 2014 in the sense that social media is different. There are resources available to the public that were not available back then. But it's also not 2014 in the sense that we are standing up here almost every day and offering the context of what we know in an effort to be as transparent as we can with the American people and the international public to do two things. In the first instance, and in a best-case scenario, to attempt to prevent, to deter the Russians from moving forward with what they are planning, what they have planned, or what they had planned all along. If we're not able to do that, and ultimately Putin will make the decision that Putin will make based on his own calculus, if we're not able to do that, what we will have done is to have put a spotlight on the fact that this was all a charade. This was all a show. And that while the Russians were claiming de-escalation, while the Russians were claiming a commitment to dialogue, that the opposite was taking place. And so that's why we've tried to be very clear about the disinformation, about the pretexts, the fact that the Russians did this precisely in 2014, and our growing alarm that the Russians may be planning a similar pretextual attempt in the coming hours, the coming days, knowing that it is very much part and parcel of their playbook.
Okay, and just last thing, you said that the troop number was now more than 150,000. Do you have a more specific number you can provide?
I'm not able to provide a more specific number, but that number has grown in recent weeks and in recent days. And as you heard the president say yesterday, it currently stands at around 150,000. Yes?
Putin could obviously order an attack at any moment. But I just wonder, vis-a-vis the specific date that was put out for today and the an attack didn't materialize, does that mean that that specific piece of intelligence was wrong?
No, it doesn't. First of all, I don't think you've heard us from any podium point to a specific day of an invasion. I think what you've heard from us from some time now is to make the point that what the Russian Federation has put in place are the capabilities it would need to order an attack at any time. But this goes back to what I was saying before and to a discussion that perhaps we had quite memorably here the other week, that if something doesn't come to pass, it doesn't necessarily mean that what we've been warning of is wrong. In the best case scenario, the Russians will have changed their calculus. I can't say what has happened in this case. What I can say is that the Russians, over several weeks and in recent days, have put in place the assets, the troops, the material that they would need to undertake an attack against Ukraine at any moment. We've been in that window for some time now. We will be in that window for some time until and unless we see de-escalation.
Secondly, quickly, I noticed that the Russian Defense Ministry has issued video showing train loads of armored vehicles heading, at least purporting to be heading across a bridge away from Crimea. What do you need to see to be convinced that there is some form of withdrawal? I mean, presumably you think that that video is not true, or what is it that you would need to see? Would it need to be backed up by satellite imagery, or...
It would need to be verified.
In what sense, though, I guess?
There are any number of ways that we have to verify them, and I'm not able to speak to all of them from the podium. But look, this is not an assessment that is ours and ours alone. You heard from the NATO Secretary General this morning, Jens Stoltenberg, that we have not seen de-escalation, and in fact, we've seen more troops head to the border. So it's difficult for us to speak with specificity when it comes to the sources and methods that we would use to verify such a claim, but I can tell you. That we are pulling every lever at our disposal in an effort to make sure that we have as much visibility as we can.
But that sort of video is propaganda, do you think?
The Russians have engaged in a great deal of propaganda and disinformation on this very question.
And just lastly, are you concerned or convinced, by the sounds of it, that Moscow is pushing this genocide line to justify invasion? And just why are we seeing that now?
Well, you would have to ask the Russian Federation why we're seeing that now, but we can say a couple things.
How concerned are you?
We're very concerned. We're very concerned because we know broadly that the Russians want to point to a fabricated pretext before undertaking aggression. It's precisely what they did in 2014 in Ukraine. These claims of genocide have haunting echoes of what we heard in 2014 regarding the persecution of Russian speakers in eastern Ukraine and Crimea. This is in some ways eerily similar to what we have experienced before. And so now that we hear Vladimir Putin, we hear other Russian officials pointing to genocide, pointing to pointing to what we have heard in the past, it gives us great concern that this could be part of the same playbook that they are reprising in the context of 2022.
Thank you.
Yes.
Today, the Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro met Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Bolsonaro did not mention the Ukrainian crisis, but he said that he has solidarity with Russia. How do you see his declarations, his trip, and the approximation between Brazil and Russia at this moment? And if this could affect the relations between Brazil and the United States in the future?
Well, we know that any number of countries, and in fact the international community, is broadly and deeply concerned about what we are all seeing taking place with Russia and Ukraine at this very moment. As democratic countries, as democratic leaders in our hemisphere, we in Brazil, we feel that we have a responsibility to stand up for the values that we share. And at the heart of those values are the principles of the rules-based international order. This is the order that has, over the course of more than seven decades now, has fueled unprecedented levels of prosperity, security, and stability in Europe, in the Indo-Pacific, but also in our own hemisphere. And so that's why it is our hope that President Bolsonaro will have taken advantage of this opportunity, this meeting with President Putin, to reinforce the very messages that are enshrined in the values we share and that are part and parcel of the rules-based international order. Again, that applies to the Western Hemisphere as it does to the Indo-Pacific and Europe. Yes, yes.
And if he did not stand for this value, it can have some consequence for the relations between the U.S. and the Brazil in the future.
I would leave it to our Brazilian counterparts to share the content and context of that discussion. Yes.
Thank you. Can I switch subjects?
Sure. Anything else on Russia-Ukraine? Go ahead.
Yeah, on Honduras, yesterday former President Juan Orlando Hernández was arrested following a request by the U.S. How are you confident, or how confident are you on his extradition moving forward? And why did the State Department not disclose that he was in its list of corrupt officials in Central America until he was out of office?
I'll correct one element of that. We did disclose the corrupt officials list, but let me get to that. As a longstanding matter of State Department policy, as you know, we don't comment on matters of extradition. Those are within the purview of the Department of Justice, and I need to refer you to the Department of Justice to speak to the process behind any particular extradition. But Secretary Blinken did state last week, when we publicized the fact that former President Hernandez was included in the corrupt and undemocratic actors list, that no one is above the law. That includes heads of state, former heads of state, and we take all allegations of criminal wrongdoing extraordinarily seriously, whether it's in Honduras, whether it's in anywhere else in this hemisphere or around the world. Our priority remains seeing the rule of law respected, implemented, strengthened, and supported by our partners as they work to ensure judicial and security sectors protect all of their citizens. These are discussions that we're having with our Honduran partners, but also partners throughout the region.
Are you satisfied with his arrest?
As a matter of when it comes to the extradition, I need to refer you to the Department of Justice. Yes, Tracy.
To follow on my colleague here, actually, Juan Orlando Hernandez was not included initially when the list was released last year and only recently put on the list, I think, last month. But his question, are you confident that Hernandez will be extradited? You know, as you know, as happens in many countries, he managed to stack the Supreme Court with his allies, and that is who, the Honduran Supreme Court, obviously, and that is who will have to rule whether they will allow the extradition or not. So I'm wondering how confident you are that that extradition will take place.
Again, as a matter of longstanding policy, we don't speak to the process of any particular extradition. So I'd have to refer you to the Department of Justice. But what I will say is that the rule of law, following the rule of law, strengthening the rule of law, implementing the rule of law is a key priority of ours, including in Central America. We know that it is a priority of the new administration there, and I think I would have to leave it at that.
Iranian foreign minister is expected to be in Munich at the security conference. Is the secretary ready, willing to meet with him directly in person if that helps having a breakthrough in Vienna?
I wouldn't expect, at least in Munich, a meeting between the secretary and the foreign minister. But what I will say, and what we have long said, is that we believe that direct talks between the United States and Tehran and Iran would be in our interest in the context of Vienna. As you know, Francesco, we have had to operate on an indirect basis with our primarily our European partners, relaying messages back and forth. And that has posed an obstacle in the context of negotiations that are technical, that are detailed, that are complex. And so we have said for some time now that we would find direct negotiations in the context of Vienna to be to our advantage. It would be to the benefit of our attempts to seek to achieve or at least test the proposition of whether we can achieve a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA.
The French foreign minister said today it's now a matter of days and no more weeks to know whether, well, to have a deal to save the JCPOA or to go in a nuclear crisis. Is that your assessment too? Is it a matter of days?
Well, our assessment is that we are in the midst of the very final stages of, as I said before, a complex negotiation with the key stakeholders here. This is really the decisive period during which we'll be able to determine whether a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA is in the offing or if it's not. Again, we are sincere and steadfast in our efforts to test the proposition as to whether a return can be achieved. We continue to believe that a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA is the best way to once again place permanent, verifiable limits on Iran's nuclear program. But we're in a decisive period because that window will very shortly have closed.
And so have you seen the political willingness from Tehran in these last days in Vienna, and when will you be able to make that assessment?
I think we'll have a much better sense of that in the coming days, and it will have to be in the coming days because, again, we're in a decisive period where all sides will have to make the political commitments that will be necessary if we are to achieve a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA. Okay. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Вот, смотрите, как это выглядит.